Hello and welcome to the Future of Europe podcast, a production by the European Network. Europe is at a crossroads and there are many predictions as to what direction it will take, and in this podcast we will look at the key issues that will affect the European sphere in the next decade. Our podcast covers the big topics that will affect the future of nations that inhabit the European continent, and we will also bring a uniquely Irish perspective and address how the smaller European states are going to progress by using Ireland as a benchmark. Our guests will be from many different walks of life and backgrounds, each bringing their own ideas on how the Europe of today will become the Europe of tomorrow. This series is presented in cooperation with the Communicating Europe Initiative, and the CEI was established in 1995 to raise awareness about the European Union and to improve the quality and accessibility of public information on European issues. You can find out more about the CEI by visiting their website at dfa.ie. My name is Ken Sweeney, and in this episode we will be discussing the future of elections and voting in Europe with my guest Tobias Schminke. Tobias is the founder of Europe Elects, which is an organisation that provides poll aggregation and election analysis for countries in the European Union. Hi Tobias, how are you?
I'm good, how are you doing, Ken?
Great. And listen, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us on the Future of Europe podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
For the listeners who don't know where you are, you're currently in Canada at the moment, isn't that right?
That's right. I'm in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
I know all about your organization, Europe Elects. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about Europe Elects and what they do.
Yeah, so Europe Elects is an election observatory, essentially. So we present and gather data on elections and polling. So if you visit our social media, you will see all polls that are published on voting intention in Europe in one spot, and you will find it in a way that you can understand it. On election days, we present election data and all results and all interesting data related to voting in one spot on our social media and on our website.
And is it just Europe you do, or is there connections around the world?
So Europe Elects covers only Europe, but we have partner organizations in Asia, America, and also Oceania and Africa. And they're called Africa Elects, America Elects, etc.
So basically, you can pull in information on anything that's interesting happening around the world with regards to voting and elections.
Correct. We provide anything that is interesting about elections.
Brilliant. And of course, it's a good gauge to see how people vote around the world, isn't it? When you work with partners like that, you can see the differences in how people view elections and how they actually work with elections.
That's right. So there is a great diversity if it comes to elections all around the world. It's also especially with if it comes to democracy, right? Democracy is almost a normal given in Europe, but in other places we have authoritarian regimes and elections are rigged, and we also focus on uncovering that.
Which is great, because we're going to start off with a big moment that happened last year with regards to the US elections. Now, voter turnout has been important in the US elections traditionally, with Democrats trying to boost turnout all the time and then Republicans seeming to work against it. Do you think that turnout is as important in the EU elections?
I do think turnout is important in any election. The public often sees turnout as a legitimation of the election process and the institutions. And the EU elections had a lot of negative press over the past decades because voter turnout was low and declining, and more positive when the trend was then reversed in 2019. So I think, yeah, voter turnout is generally vital in any election.
Ex-Soviet EU members seem to have a lower turnout than other member states. Does that seem to suggest that a tradition of democracy is a factor, or is it something else at work?
Yeah, so we do see lower turnouts in Eastern European EU member states. So political scientists debate what is at play if it comes to voter turnout. Generally, if voters think their vote matters and makes a difference, they're more willing to vote. But it's interesting to note that voter turnout is generally 10 points higher in countries where it is possible to vote by mail, in advance, or by a proxy, rather than in countries where that's not the place. And especially in Eastern Europe, we could still improve on that. For in Canada, for example, here, you can vote weeks in advance in person at a polling station. So that would be something policymakers in Europe could look at.
Yeah, there's not many countries that do that in Europe, in particular the EU, is there?
That's right. So even in Western Europe or Central Europe and Germany, that doesn't exist. And that would be something I would propose as a point of improvement.
Do you think that's down to trust?
I was thinking about that before, because there could be concerns about how that would be organized, who'd be supervising the polling booths over weeks. Mm. But in Canada, there's a smooth process in place, and I think other countries can look at Canada and then see how they're doing it.
I noticed that you have some countries in the European Union that allow people to vote who are based outside of their country. I mean, what's your opinion on that? In a future Europe, and let's just say they were consolidating, imagine that they were consolidating the way they vote. So would you be in favour of allowing citizens from a country of the EU being allowed to vote while they're outside of the country?
Yeah, so for example, in Romania, we have a huge, huge community that lives abroad and they just temporarily live abroad. Mm. And I think as long as there is a clear and transparent process in place on who can still vote in terms of how many years they have spent outside of the country, I think that is fine. I just think we should have a standardized and transparent approach across borders. And I do think it is an important means to generate turnout, because we have countries where you still need to go to your original village or the village where you register to vote. And that's just a voter oppression. That's what you would call it in the US, right?
Yeah.
So we should have a liberal approach to voting from abroad.
But obviously, I think as well, would it be a case that we may need to put limitations on that? For example, if somebody is a Romanian citizen, but they haven't lived in Romania for a period of time, say 2 to 3 years, should they be restricted from voting, do you think? Or would that be difficult to enforce?
I mean, voting is inherently intertwined with citizenship, right? So that's a very difficult process to disentangle, or a difficult relationship to disentangle. But I would not impose something as an expert, but rather maybe involve citizens in deciding this, maybe through a referendum or political deliberation in general.
And of course, there's the argument as well that, you know, some people who live abroad see a sunnier side, or they may not be informed in the politics of their country. You know, some people may not have been there for 20 years, for example, and that can have an effect on the country, even though those people are not there. Should that be monitored, or do you think it's an unfortunate kind of side effect of allowing, as you say, a more liberal system?
Yeah, that's a funny point, because, for example, if you look at the expat communities in North America, they tend to vote significantly more conservative than actually polls in Poland. Or we have communities outside of Turkey that vote more for Erdogan than communities that live inside Turkey. But I think that's just an unfortunate side effect, as you're saying. And at the end, I don't want to make or impose a recommendation. I think that that would be part of a deliberative process of the voters themselves.
Yeah,
or as politicians to come up with.
Yeah, and we'll talk about artificial intelligence later on. But I suppose there are ways and means around that by using in digital formats that can allow, you know, can keep an idea on what the voter trends are, isn't it? It's easier to do that.
Yeah, and I think we can learn a lot from other countries here as well. Estonia has successfully implemented online voting for a while now, but other countries haven't pushed for that yet. And I think that's something we can look at too.
Yeah, I just want to touch on the topic now, because again, this is something that happens with the diaspora as well. You often hear that young people are disengaged from politics. Now, you look on Facebook and so on, and you see that may not be true. But then again, Facebook is not always a good demographic. It doesn't always tell the proper story. But I'm wondering, Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, they've showed that young people can in fact be mobilized to vote. So what lessons can other political candidates take from the likes of that?
Yeah, so I think here are also several factors at play again. Young voters tend to vote for the left in most Western countries anyway already, but you're right, Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn were pretty successful in using this general tendency. I think they address income inequality and climate change, and not just vaguely, they had concrete ideas and that resonated with young people. They also somewhat challenged the consensus of liberal economics, which resonates with a society that was less exposed to the general anti-left Cold War rhetorics than older generations. So that might play a reason as well, because the older generations have always been under the impression of Cold War rhetorics. So maybe that plays a role here. And of course, you already mentioned it, both of them use social media very well, which is something other politicians can learn from.
It's not just at play on the right either and on the far left. I mean, there's a lot of, say, young politicians coming through in the middle ground. I mean, there are some who would argue with my contention here, but Sebastian Kurz, for example, he would be considered a centre-right. But he's quite young. So my question is young people getting engaged, or are basically older people still voting for young guns like Sebastian Kurz? Because the general age, from what I can see, in terms of leaders coming in, it's lowering all the time. So is it because young people are voting, or is it because older people are more fascinated with these younger candidates?
That's a good question. Maybe also we're just getting older, so we think the others are getting younger. Anyway, just jokes aside, I don't think that necessarily plays a role. So Sebastian Kurz, he has a voter base that is older, while Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn address a voter base that is younger. But I don't think that there's necessarily a connection or trend here. Maybe because of social media, younger politicians have an easier chance to reach out to the voter base than they had when they had to go through television. Yeah. So there is no established single process, but they can involve young voters more easily, and also get exposed more easily. Maybe that is a reason.
Yeah. Now, your organization, EuropeElects, you use algorithms and exit polls to analyze and predict all the results. So how will such systems change in the next 5 to 10 years? Will we see such developments as real-time results?
Yeah, that's right. So actually, in the Czech election that was earlier this month, EuropeElects had for the first time live election results being presented on our website. So if you go to our website following national parliamentary elections in the future, you will see live results on our website. In general, big data will totally change how we look at election. I expect big data to fully transform our elections end to end. So from how targeted election campaigns happen, how a voter is being addressed or influenced, to including big data models to predict elections.
And are we going to see the end of exit polls then? Because they seem to be still a bit of a wild card when it comes to prediction. I know here in Ireland, we had the last European parliamentary elections in 2018, and we had a Green candidate who started off really, really well. And then suddenly they were predicting that she got the seat. And then suddenly she lost to coming into, like, when the vote started to actually come in. So is it fact that when you look at real time election results, that exit polls will become more redundant?
Yeah, so exit polling and the quality of exit polling differs a lot between countries. So in Germany, for example, exit polling is super precise. And given the current ability we have in working with big data, I don't see an end for exit polling anytime soon.
And when you say that Germany has a really good way of doing it, how do they do it so well? What is their secret?
Germans are lucky because the electoral system, if it comes to proportional votes, is relatively straightforward. While exit polls who try to operate in systems with single transferable vote have a little bit of a harder time.
And with regard, say, to when you look at exit polls in the UK, are they, because they have a completely different voting system to, say, a lot of the countries in Europe, which is proportional representation, they have a first past the post. Is it difficult to predict exit polls with them, or is it easier?
I would say it's a little bit harder because you have to think about each constituency, and if you're off by just 1% in your exit poll, you would probably have several constituencies switching because the margin between the candidates and first past the post systems like the UK is oftentimes relatively small. So you might see 15 seats switching if just the vote shares shifting in the exit poll by 1%. So that makes it tricky.
I wanted to keep on the first past the post. Is it still a valid way to vote in a modern world?
That's kind of the never-ending debate also here in Canada. I do think it's a valid way to vote. I'm not a fan of the system myself, but I think if the public generally agrees that this is a legitimate process to come up with a candidate, then that's okay.
But if you have, say, like the way with the UK, if you have a dominating party, say like the Tories, and then you have the Labour Party that are fluctuating in terms of their ability to catch up, is the first past the post an advantage to, say, somebody like the Tories?
Yeah, it certainly is an advantage for a bigger parties. That's essentially de Verges' law. But if you decide that regional representation is more important than proportional representation, if you want to make sure that each town and city is represented in parliament, then the first past the post system is one viable option.
Yeah. And of course, if you know, there's a lot of talk post Brexit about the UK, what its future is. We had a very long discussion. We had three guests on from Wales, Scotland and England discussing the possibilities of the country splitting up. And it is a realistic possibility as time goes on. I mean, certainly Scotland is looking for independence outright. The Welsh independence movement is growing by the day. So in terms of the voting system in the UK, do you think that a proportional representation would suit a smaller country as, say, in England? Or would they have to look at a complete change, do you think, if they wanted to keep their system in check?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because we're kind of taking two steps at a time, right?
Yeah.
So you're right that there is a real possibility that Scotland and also Northern Ireland are going to split from the United Kingdom. As per current polls, that's the first interesting point. And there is a lot of support for first past the post, especially in England, right? Mm. So I don't see that this is going to change just because Scotland and Northern Ireland split off. I would say that rather Scotland is more in favor of proportional representation than the rest of the United Kingdom. So with them splitting off, I don't see that the popular demand for proportional representation is going to increase.
Yeah. And in regards to, say, a country like the UK, if that was to happen, I know this is a big question and we're talking about the future here, so I don't expect you to give me a, you know, a predictable answer. If the UK was to split in some way, do you think it would learn from, say, how Germany works with in regards to being a federation? Or is there a case that the UK system would survive anyway?
I mean, what is really left once Scotland splits off and then Northern Ireland maybe also secedes? How would you organize a federation in that? Mm. I mean, what I think was rather a possibility is that there is some sort of compromise, at least temporarily, that the UK transforms into a federation to make sure that Scotland does not split off. However, we also have such an entrenched system of parliamentary superiority and such an entrenched system of a unitary state that will take a lot of political bargaining.
No, I appreciate you giving that answer because I was giving that one on the spot. But I always think the UK politics are very interesting and the way they vote and the way they conduct themselves. It's kind of like it's so traditional yet at the same time. It seems to be adapting as it goes along, struggling in some ways, but adapting. I'm going to move on to my country, Ireland, and it's right next door to the UK. Of course, our voting system and our electoral system is it learned a lot from 800 years of British rule. So we kind of hit the ground pretty well because a lot of our civil servants and so on, people who worked in government administration were already there before we became independent. So we've always had a pretty good system when it comes to voting. And I think our system has already been proved to be fairly honest. I'm sure you'll agree. But I want to talk about the recent referendums that we had in Ireland, mainly the repeal of the 8th Amendment and the allowing for the legislation of abortion in some circumstances. Do you think that any lessons could be learned from the Irish campaigns and the way the referendums were conducted by the Irish administrations? Was it noticed in Europe?
Yeah, I'm not trying to be super nice to you just so you invite me again to the podcast, but I do think we can learn a lot from Ireland. So the referendum in Ireland, for example, set a procedural example. Different from the Brexit referendum, there was a more deliberative process before the referenda. And what I mean is, think of the Citizens' Assembly that lined out how referenda should be held. I don't think that the Irish approach in that is a one-fits-all, but certainly something to look at for policymakers in preparing a referendum, having a citizens' assembly that transparently lines out the process on how to hold referenda.
So maybe it might be an idea. Can we explain the citizens' assembly to our listeners? Because probably they don't know. So I'll probably start off then and you can probably tell me where I'm going wrong. I mean, the citizens' assembly is a kind of it's a group of people who come together from different walks of life in Ireland and they sit down and they look at all proposals that are, you know, in lieu with the constitutional change. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, that's right. And they're generally randomly selected. There are different types of citizens' assemblies across the world, but generally they're randomly assembled and they're only there for a specific period of time. And then they discuss, for example, the wording in some cases of these referenda. And the wording is important because depending on how you pose a question, the outcome of the referenda could be influenced. So it's really important that this has been peer reviewed and agreed on.
Yeah, and of course then there's the referendum commission, which is set up prior after that to make sure that the education about the referendum is both balanced and fair.
Exactly. So how, for example, do you present advertising on public broadcasts? This is something that could be discussed to make sure that everybody deems the process of the referendum as fair.
Could the template be used as a benchmark for a future Europe?
I mean, many national EU member states don't even have referenda on the national level. But sure, if we think many years ahead under a new treaty, this could be an option. But of course, it's always also important to remember that referenda have a certain risk in terms of minority protection and the level of how voters are really informed about the topics, right? We saw that with Brexit. People voted for something and now they realize, oh, we didn't think about all the truck drivers that bring us our turkey on Christmas and fuel over the holidays, right? So there is always risk connected to referenda, but certainly if we have to have a referenda and if we ever think about it, Ireland is probably a good example for Europe to learn from.
And I'm going to go back to that, what you said about Brexit there a moment ago. But before I do, I want to talk to you about the Swiss way of doing referendums. They do a lot of referendums, don't they?
Oh, yeah, they do. I think Switzerland has four designated days every year on which they have several referenda.
And is it a good system? Is it locked down well? In other words, has it got plenty of experience behind it and it runs pretty good?
Yeah, there are people who support it, right, as the popular will. But again, we also have seen some cases where minority rights were limited in favor of the majority. So if we remember, of course, a referendum that somehow related to Islam, we see that minorities might not be happy with how that is turning out. And the process is not as deliberative as in Ireland, I would say.
Yeah.
Because you have a citizens' initiative, for example, that submits a question rather than having the community coming together and all debating a certain question. But of course, there are also examples where we can learn from in Switzerland.
Yeah, I think, I mean, probably every system in the European Union memberships have good parts that we can all learn from. And this is the whole idea, isn't it? That if you were to standardize across Europe in a future Europe, that you would look at everyone's voting system. You couldn't dismiss anybody. Sure, you can't.
Exactly. And I think the Swiss example is a good example because let's keep in mind that Switzerland is a federation, meaning they bring together different language groups, they bring together different confessional groups, and that pretty successfully over many years now. And that would be something that is interesting for Europe because we'll also, if we ever move towards a united Europe, it would be a federation just like Switzerland, most likely. And it would be something that would need to bring together different identity groups. So that is something we could learn from Switzerland.
And of course, if you try and apply direct democracy in, say, a country like Hungary, that could have negative effects, though, couldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. As I said, if we look at Hungary, we see that the democracy has been so damaged recently by the authorities, limiting the public space that we do have some sort of popular democracy, but it infringes on the rights of minorities. And that's always a balance you have to find in how far you constitutionally protect and de facto protect minorities, while at the same time also having some sort of popular democracy.
The further east you go, trends change, don't they, and how people vote. There's a lot more populism in the Eastern European countries. Could that be a case that these democracies are just still in their infancy? And that, you know, even though Hungary has had a democracy for 30 years, in relative terms, that's not particularly long.
That is correct. And I wouldn't even limit it, to be honest, to Eastern Europe. I think that voters are essential a little bit, or we all are a little bit like animals, and we react to our outside forces and outside influences. So we're not these rational choice voters we'd like to be.
Yeah,
we're driven by emotions. We're driven by feelings. So we need to make sure, or the policymakers need to make sure, that they provide a background and setting where voters can make a deliberative choice. In that sense, that would be necessary to really have a functioning democracy that protects minorities and that is successful on the long run.
And of course, functioning democracies need to protect its citizens from the influence of social media, because we've seen that on a detrimental scale in the United States. So is it a case of extending blackouts to social media platforms as we do with television stations and radio stations? Do you think that could be something that should be looked at in the future Europe when it comes to voting?
When you say blackouts, what do you mean?
Well, in Ireland, for example, we have a 24-hour blackout, news blackout. So in other words, there's no interviews, no commentary, nothing allowed before the day of the election. Do you think that should be applied in some cases to social media? Because social media is having such a huge effect, both positive and negative, on election voting.
Yeah, that's a funny question, because we have something like this in Spain where you're not allowed to publish any polls, I think 2 weeks before the election. But then we see that on social media, polls are being published from Andorra just in that time for Spain. So I'm wondering how that would look like and how enforceable these blackouts really are if you work with social media, just from a like feasibility standpoint.
But certainly you are involved every single day in social media, your team works with it. Is it naive to say that it doesn't have a huge influence on voting?
I do think social media has a significant influence on voting, and it will become even more powerful. Mm. The trends at the moment are that political campaigners are looking more and more into individual targeting of voters. So they know that you like a cheesecake, black cars, and other things, very specific preferences you have, mm-hmm. and they use preferences even if they're not political, and they are able to target you because of these preferences, and from an emotional and feelings point of view, loop you in and convince you to support a party, right? So there's not necessarily even rational factors at play.
Yeah.
And this will become more and more advanced, and that's something policymakers actually need to think about, because where does convincing stop and where does manipulation start if we work with social media?
Are you concerned about that?
I think we should be concerned about it, because as I'm saying, it's not always clear when we cross the border to manipulation,
yeah.
where we just loop people into something that they actually don't support. That's something policymakers should be looking into.
The reason I ask you that question is because that could be a serious issue in terms of a border poll for Irish unity, because you have a situation which is very unique. You have a situation where you have two countries voting. Only one section of that country is allowed to vote, but the other country, in this case, the Republic of Ireland, will have a massive influence on the future of the United Kingdom. So it's like as if the UK is waiting to see whether Ireland will allow them to stay together. So that would be a clear case, I'm sure, where you could have a lot of manipulation from outside influencers, namely people in the UK and in England.
Yeah. The question is if you have a strong interest behind
yeah.
that, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if public or private actors in Ireland have a strong influence of really influencing that vote in their favor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not informed enough about the setting.
I don't think anybody is, actually. So it's probably something that will inevitably happen. And I think that when we vote in this border poll, should it happen, we will not just be voting for a united Ireland, but we're also voting for the UK to lose its percentage of its area. And in this case, unlike Brexit, the people in the United Kingdom, i.e. the mainland of the UK, actually don't get a chance to decide that. So there's in a sense, it's a complicated situation that could be open to, as I said, outside forces manipulating the actual outcome.
Yeah, I mean, there are two dimensions here. The first one is that you have the normative question, who should be allowed about the future of Northern Ireland, mm-hmm. right? Should it just be the people in Northern Ireland, or should it also be people outside? And then you're right, maybe the UK government will try to influence the public discourse in Northern Ireland in their favor, meaning keeping Northern Ireland with them. But I would really need to speculate about this. I don't know enough about this.
Yeah, me neither. But I think it's going to be an interesting situation should it happen. Do you think that artificial intelligence will have any influence on the future of voting in Europe? Because I'm thinking about predictions and how we actually vote in elections and referendums, and then how we use voting machines online and pre-elections voting, as you said.
Yeah, so as I said, I think artificial intelligence will have a significant influence on voting. I'm not just thinking about online voting and stuff like this, but also about how we predict elections and how we can use big data to first substantiate exit polls, but then also maybe just work with big data at some point, but that's still a very long way ahead. But as I said, I'm also mostly concerned about how voters are being targeted by election campaigners and making sure that social media remain a tool of convincing and not to become a tool of manipulation.
I wanted to give you an idea and see, would it be a case that eventually it could come to a point where people would be downloading an app to vote in an election?
Yeah, absolutely. I could see that happening. I mean, you have certain ways of verifying that a voter is really voting through their designated device. And mm-hmm. I'm serious security concerns would be, of course, important. But I do think that at some point we end up there.
And the day the ballot box will basically disappear.
I mean, I hope and I don't think we'll see the ballot box disappear for a very long time.
Yeah.
But maybe 100 years down the road, I don't know, maybe then people will be listening to this podcast and they will be like, oh, Ken saw it coming. No more ballot.
And also, I think politicians wouldn't like to see it go because they just love that photo op, don't they? That is the ultimate photo op, isn't it? To see him standing.
Exactly, with the kids and with the partner. They come and make that's kind of the last push for the voters. See how nice my family looks. Vote for me.
Yeah, it doesn't look good when you just see a manicured finger pressing green or red on an app. You know, Tobias, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I think we could probably go on for another half an hour. I know I digressed with a couple of questions, but it was just getting too interesting to leave them aside. Can I ask you again, could you please tell me how can everyone find out about Europe Elects? Because I just want to say before you give us that answer, you guys are doing an amazing job. You've been doing an amazing job for a long time now. And as you know, I've been following you guys from day one. I saw you go from a small little organization to appearing on the likes of Euronews and so on. And I really hope that you continue. Everything is good at Europelects at the moment, isn't it?
Everything's good. And also thank you for the positive feedback. If your listeners don't know us yet, we'll just online search for Europelects. Mm-hmm. We have a website, but the real action happens on our social media. Mm-hmm. We also have a podcast where we contextualize whatever happens regarding elections every 2 weeks. We also now have an online shop. I'm not sure I'm
yes,
allowed to say this.
Absolutely. Tell us about your online shop. Come on.
We have an online shop where you can buy different maps. So we would visualize election results on maps. And then you can buy this and put this in your room. I find it beautiful. I have one myself. Mm-hmm. Then also, just if you are interested in anything that relates to elections in Europe, just visit our website. Everything is what we present as context free. So, and that's also important for us that we educate citizens and provide information for free. And yeah, just have a look.
What's the next great thing coming out of EuropeElects? Can you give us any hints? Is there anything planned in the pipeline?
Yeah, so we're heading now into winter, which means we don't have so many elections, but next year, and we're preparing for that already, and we're posting polls almost every day about it, are the Hungarian and the French elections in the first half of the year. And yeah, so have a look. The polls are pretty exciting, what's happening in France at the moment.
Yeah.
With new candidates showing up on the political landscape that could significantly shift the outcome of what's happening next year.
If you want to check out their brilliant podcast, if you go to our website, theeuropeannetwork.eu, and just click on Podtronica, which is one of the tabs there, you'll find the podcast. The podcast just isn't about elections. You do lots of stories about European nations and so on in general, don't you?
Yeah, and we have interesting guests. We invite journalists, academics, on politicians, and listen to their perspective, how they do their work, and their inside knowledge.
Tobias, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It's really brilliant. We had a great conversation. I could have gone longer and longer. My name is Ken Sweeney and you've been listening to the Future of Europe podcast. As I said, we are on theeuropeannetwork.eu and you can get our podcasts on all the major platforms, be they Spotify, Google, Apple and so on. So take care and goodbye.
The Future of Europe podcast is a production by the European Network in partnership with the Department of Foreign Affairs in Ireland. Executive production by Ken Sweeney. Research and development by Brian Milne and Francis Cowell. Writing assistance by Ola Jasińska. You can find our podcast at theeuropeannetwork.eu.